Oh my, we're going to go on to case number 4. And that's 1230104. It's United States versus Fletcher. Good morning, Mr. Cupsis.
Good morning, Your Honor. May I approach?
I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Morning. This fault is Cupsis on behalf of the appellate, Randall Fletcher. May it please the court. Our appeal essentially deals with the effect of Pew versus United States in regard to whether or not Mr. Fletcher's ex post facto rights were violated when the court sentenced him under 2011 sentencing guidelines for in part offenses that occurred in 2002. Essentially, the history is that in 2002, materials were found which led to charges against Mr. Fletcher, three counts. The most serious charge, sexual exploitation of a minor, which was count one, and also activities related to material constituting child pornography as well as possession of child pornography. Under the 2002 guidelines when the offense occurred, had they been calculated, Mr. Fletcher would have been looking at a level 35 in regard to the sexual exploitation of a minor, a level 32 in regard to counts 2 and 3. There was also a cross-reference in which, since there was abuse of a minor involved, that counts 2 and 3 would have the guideline level of count 1, and with the grouping rules, he would have been looking at an offense level of 37. If Mr. Fletcher had stopped committing crimes at that point in time, this would be a pretty easy argument under Pew. Unfortunately,
didn't Judge Rogner make your job a little bit harder in your argument with that opinion she just released?
I read the Valone opinion, but I think it falls under the same aspect as Halliman, as Pagan Farrar, and also as Vivid, okay? Because what Mr. Fletcher did was the most heinous crime, sexual abuse of an actual victim, stopped in 2002. In 2004, apparently, Mr. Fletcher obtains another computer, starts collecting child pornography, but not of that same victim, not of any live victim, just a simple accumulation of pornography. Under Vivid, under Vallone, under all of those decisions, basically what we're looking at is, does a defendant have notice if he continues to commit related offenses? In this particular case, the sexual exploitation of a minor was not a related offense to the collection of child pornography. The court, in sentencing Mr. Fletcher, found that the cross-reference applied to counts 2 and 3, that being the abuse of a minor that happened in count 1. All of that conduct occurred in 2002. The court did not find that that conduct occurred in 4 and 5. So as a result, the initial sentence was based upon count 1, which occurred in 2002, under 2011 guidelines or a level of 44. The court also determined that counts 2 through 5, which it grouped completely, came up with an offense level of 42, which was raised by two levels based on the cross-reference that the court found in counts 2 and 3, not in 4 and 5. As a result, Mr. Fletcher's total offense level was a 44. When you apply the grouping laws, it was 46, and then it was reduced by sentencing guidelines to 43. So basically, in calculating its sentence, the court utilized only count 1, count 2, count 3, because essentially counts 4 and 5 were superfluous since the cross-reference did not apply to them. And the court specifically found that the cross-reference applied to 2 and 3. As a result, there is a 10-level difference that Mr. Fletcher would have been facing for counts 1, 2, and 3 if he had been found or utilized the 2002 guidelines. He would have been looking at a level 32. As opposed to this, he's looking at a level 43. Now, under Vivette, we again look at whether or not these are related offenses. And I think you have, and that's where we come in. Well, first of all, my argument is it's not a related offense. The sexual exploitation of a minor was the more heinous offense, which stopped in 2002. The simple pornography picked up again in 2004, but those are not the same or conspiratorial type offenses like the tax evasion in Vallone or
It's not simple pornography.
Well, child pornography, yeah. I apologize.
Yeah.
I guess It's a child pornography offense that doesn't involve a live victim, which is the difference between 2000.
You say that, but those, there are victims to that as well. And they are alive and they're damaged.
It's not
by
a production case.
Right, it's not a production case. I'll give you that much. And that's, but there are live victims, and it does.
They're obviously victims, and they're obviously individuals. But my point is, the production case, which also drives the guidelines in this case, was a more heinous case, the one that was subject to more severe penalty, and that occurred and stopped in 02. Now, if you look at the one group, one book rule, what it leads to is a result that we have where counts 2 and 3, which are aggravated by the sexual offense on the production count, from the production account, are being treated more harshly because of the new guidance in 2011. But the other thing that was never brought up because of the cross-reference and the fact that 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 were grouped together is the fact that there's a five-level increase because under the guidelines there's a five-level increase if, in fact, there is sexual abuse of a minor. And the court found that that applied in 2 and 3. There is no evidence that there was sexual abuse of a minor that would have applied in 4 and 5. So if you even look independently at where we would be at if we just looked at 4 or 5 under the 2011 guidelines, there's an inappropriate five-level bump. So that would be a 37 also. Our position is that under Pugh, and I think I can distinguish the court's opinion in Bologna, which was a tax conspiracy that basically straddled a guideline increase, Vivit, which is a medical fraud conspiracy that took place over a course of time, but these were all clearly conspiratorial type offenses or related offenses. The government itself argued at sentencing that counts 2 and 3 should be grouped separately from counts 4 and 5 because they were unrelated and they were separated in time. That's essentially the position the judge took when he used the cross-reference, but he only applied it to counts 2 and 3. For that reason, the starting point in the calculation of the guidelines is incorrect, even though the judge went and gave Mr. Fletcher a below-guideline sentence, according to Pugh. His decision may still have been impacted because he improperly calculated the guidelines. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Ralston, good morning.
Good morning. Sonia Ralston for the United States. May it please the Court. I'd like to start with the discussion of the pattern of abuse guideline. This is 2G2.25. It's a five-level enhancement, and it would have applied to counts 4 and 5 just as it applied to counts 2 and 3. There's nothing in that enhancement that requires it to be conduct that's part of the offense of conviction. It's more like a criminal history type of enhancement, and this defendant, through the statutory rape that he was on probation for, it was part of that murder conspiracy in state court, as well as the prior production offenses. That's two prior instances of abuse, which is a pattern of abuse, which means the enhancement applies.
Now, all of the counts are related.
Yes.
But the court treated count one as distinct enough that it was not grouped and the sentence was not concurrent. That difference has caused me a lot of thought, I must say, because in our recent decision in Hallahan, the second crime was a continuing offense that straddled the guidelines change. Here we have, as Mr. Kupsis has argued, we have these separate and distinct offenses that straddle the change in the guidelines. So help me out. Why does Hallahan apply in those circumstances?
Your Honor, the guidelines themselves answer this question. The grouping rules in 3D1.2 explain when to group offenses together. Now, one of those rules explicitly prohibits the grouping of the production offense in count one with the possession and receipt offenses in counts 2 through 5. So that answers the question about why, even though they're related, they're not grouped. The district court didn't have a choice about that. The guidelines mandate that non-grouping. And the second thing about running the sentences consecutively, the guidelines also explain that that is how you should impose the sentence. So the guidelines ask the court to calculate one total offense level for all of the conduct in the indictment and related conduct, and then if the statutory maximum for each individual count is not sufficient to cover the imposed sentence, to impose the sentences to run consecutively or partially consecutively to get to that total. And you could get to the same result in this case if you took count one entirely out of the picture. So if you...
Well, wait a minute. If Fletcher was sentenced only for count one, the court would have erred under Pugh by using the most recent sentencing.
Yes, Your Honor.
My concern is that the court essentially made that error and then made all the other counts consecutive to the sentence for count one. Do you see where I'm coming from?
I do, Your Honor. And I think the thought experiment I'm asking the court to undertake is not to imagine he had been sentenced only on count one, but the opposite of that, to imagine he had been sentenced only for counts two through four. If you look only at counts two through four, as defense counsel acknowledged, the offense level was 44. Those counts properly group under the guidelines. They never argued that they don't. They haven't pressed that on appeal. When you an offense level of 44 is identical to an offense level of 46 because anything over 43 is reduced to 43 because that's as high as the system goes. So whatever you did with count one, whatever, even if it were error, which I don't think it is, and I'm happy to talk about that, it's harmless.
Well, let me ask you this. If we were to determine that count one needed to be sentenced in accordance with the 2001 guidelines, do you believe the Third or the Ninth Circuit's approach to sentencing is more consistent with the guidelines?
I think that's a very difficult question, Your Honor. So the Third Circuit, in the one hand, says that you should continue to apply the one-book rule mm-hmm. and put one book altogether, but that presents a situation that the Commission has never envisioned, because they envision that because of the last book rule, you will always be using the most recent book if there's continuing conduct. And that creates a perverse incentive, where, as in this case, the defendant would receive a lower guidelines level if everything were under the 2001 guidelines than he would if even only counts four and five were considered. You wouldn't have the cross-reference, but you'd still have the pattern of abuse. You'd be at 42 instead of 37. And that essentially benefits the defendant for having committed more crime. That's, you know, the Commission never envisioned that. And the entire theory behind the guidelines, behind the grouping rules, and behind these cross-references is to look at real offense sentencing, to take the charging decision out of the situation as much as possible, and to look at what the defendant did. And the Third Circuit's decision is essentially charge-based sentencing. So, you know, I think that presents problems. The Ninth Circuit's approach, on the other hand, presents, not so much in this case, but in some cases could present more logistical problems about how you apply more than one book at the same time. To avoid those logistical problems, the Commission has suggested that you only apply one book ever. But because this has not come up, you know, there's one decision, the Third Circuit's decision in Surferstein, that postdates the implementation of 1B1.11 that's ever addressed this issue. So it's not something that the department necessarily has come to a final position on, and reiterate that it's not necessary to decide this case, because counts two through four get you to the same place, and that's enough. You know, I would also point out that the Ninth Circuit's approach in Ortlund amounts in many cases to, as it would in this case, a semantic difference, where because you still take into account the relevant conduct, you know, it would result in a difference in this case for the sentences for counts two through four, two through five being run consecutively and count one being set perhaps at a lower level concurrently. But that makes no real difference as to the amount of time that the defendant's serving in prison or his overall sentence. If there are any other questions, we'll rest in our brief.
Thank you. Come on up.
Did I burn all my time or do I have anything left?
I just wanted to address two things, Your Honor.
How much time?
2 minutes.
2 minutes.
First of all, in regards to the pattern of activity, the court never determined that for 4 and 5. If you take a look at the court's ruling, it definitely found that there was an increase mandated for sexual abuse of a minor related to counts 2 and 3. But right now we're open as to what the court would do if presented with an issue of whether or not the 5-level bump for pattern of sexual activity related to a minor applied to counts 4 and 5. Because simple receipt, possession of child pornography does not trigger that. Whether or not the break was sufficient from when the activity discontinued in 2002 of the actual production of pornography to the start of the collection practices in 2004, I think is arguable, and I think the court hasn't reached that decision and could do so upon a remand for sentencing. The one thing that kind of jumps out at me, and maybe it's a little bit of reflection of how to handle this type of a situation, does lead us to the guidelines also and to the grouping. I mean, we have different non-grouping offenses which have their own guideline levels, which then are counted as multiple counts. I don't understand why the same concept wouldn't apply if we have a 2002 offense and a 2009 offense, and that it can simply be recognized that different guideline levels apply, and then the multiple accounts grouping enhancement. That seems to make sense to me in this particular case. I'm not sure how you can efficiently deal with this situation. Granted, it's an unusual set of facts, but we do have two distinct crimes or two distinct time periods for crimes, and it's not a general pattern of activity, and it wasn't treated that way by the court. Thank you.
It's so unusual. This case is so unusual because I kept thinking, why didn't the government get a warrant in 2002? Why?
And the troubling factor, as opposed to Callahan,
he kept doing it for 7 more years.
The troubling factor, Callahan controlled their time frame as far as the crimes. In this case, the government did by not searching the device, not filing the charges in 02, 03, 04, 05, 06, 07, 08. That's a little bit of a difference there, too. I don't think it's pertinent to the analysis, but it is different from what happened in Callahan, where there's a lot of blame placed on the defendants for fleeing for a considerable period of time. Thank you very much.
Gosh, thank you. You were appointed,
yeah,
weren't you?
I was, Your Honor.
Gosh, thank you so much for doing such a fine job for your client. And thank you very much for doing such a fine job for your client. And the case will be taken under advisement.